We're going to be looking at all of chapter 7 and then part of chapter 8 this morning in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 7, we'll read down to verse 10 of chapter 8 this morning. The Bible says in Isaiah 7 verse 1, "In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin the king of Syria and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. When the house of David was told, 'Syria is in league with Ephraim,' the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. The Lord said to Isaiah, 'Go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. And say to him, "Be careful, be quiet. Do not fear and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and terrify it. Let us conquer it for ourselves and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim shall be shattered from being a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all." Again the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask a sign of the Lord your God, let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test." And he said, "Hear then, O house of David. Is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. In that day the Lord will whistle for the fly that's at the end of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee that's in the land of Assyria. And they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rock and on all the thorn bushes and on all the pastures. In that day the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it will sweep away the beard also. In that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and because of the abundance of milk that they give, he will eat curds, for everyone who is left in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day, every place where there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. With bow and arrows, a man will come there, for all the land will be briars and thorns. And as for all the hills that used to be hoed with a hoe, you will not come there for fear of briars and thorns, but they will become a place where cattle are let loose and where sheep tread." Then the Lord said to me, "Take a large tablet and write on it in common characters, 'Belonging to Maher Shalal Hashbaz,' and I will get reliable witnesses, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah, to attest for me." I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said to me, "Call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to cry, 'My father or my mother,' or 'Daddy and mommy,' the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria." We've heard his name a few times. King of Assyria, king of Assyria. Verse 5, "The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people has refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently, and they rejoice over Rezin the son of Remaliah, therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Be broken, you peoples, and be shattered. Give ear, all you far countries. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand. Because Emmanuel, God with us. Well, as we come to this morning's passage, it's important for us to remember that God's people have been here before. There's a crisis. We could go back to Moses and the children of Israel. They've left Egypt, and they've wandered in the wilderness just a little bit, and enough to make Pharaoh think that they're lost. They come up to the Red Sea, there's mountains, and there's an army behind them. And it's at this moment that God says through Moses, "Be still, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord." We've seen it as Moses brought the children of Israel up to the very edges of the promised land. And as he told the 12 spies, he says, "Go up and see what the land is. Go in and see whether it is good." And they come back with these huge clusters of grapes, 6 feet long, carried on poles between two men. "Or see if it's bad." And 10 come back with a report that it's bad. 2 come back with a report that it's good. They both see the same land. But there's a crisis. And in that crisis, there's a decision to be made, to walk by faith or to walk by sight. God's people are going to be here again at the end of the whole story. God gives a warning to 7 churches. And he says, "Listen, there is an apocalypse coming. It will be the end of the world as we know it. And it's not all right. You've got 2 choices. You can either walk with the lion lamb and inherit the kingdom, or you can walk by sight, not by faith, and side with the dragon, but you must inherit the curse if that is your choice." There's a crisis, and because of the crisis, there's a decision to be made. And in light of that decision, there's a destiny to be reached. Crisis, decision, destiny. Crisis, decision, destiny. It's almost like it's a pattern or maybe a theme. We come to a world that looks bleak. It looks worn. It looks weary. It looks lifeless. And we're tempted to walk by fear. We don't like what we see. There's decisions to make. So we're going to make those decisions in light of our security. Fear is insecurity, and what insecurity does is it forces us to try manipulate our own security. But God offers us a pair of glasses, and he says, "I offer you the vision of faith." I'm reminded of that song that says, "I am his and he is mine," right? I think it's 185. You got a hymn book in front of you. We'll see if we read these words right together. 185, the second stanza. "Heaven above is softer blue. Earth around is sweeter green. Something lives in every hue that Christless eyes have never seen. Birds with gladder songs overflow. Flowers with deeper beauty shine, since I know as now I know, I am his and he is mine." When you walk by faith, life looks different. It just does. Have you ever walked outside and seen something and walked outside a different day and it looks totally different? I mean, it's the same thing, it's same lighting, you just see it from a different vantage point. Have you ever done that? Every once in a while, I'll walk out these front steps, And I'll see Valley View the way I saw it the very first time I walked into Valley View. I was like, whoa, it's like a blast from the past. It's just, you catch it in a different light. Okay, it's the same thing. It's just seen with different eyes. Here's the reality that's at work. Okay, there's two different lenses. And those two lenses open for us two different worlds. It's the same world, but it's not. Depending on which pair of lenses you're looking through. So as we walk into this passage, we see that this is kind of a theme of God's people. Crisis, decision, destiny, fear or faith. Which world are you going to walk in? I want you to note just a couple of quotes from some of the commentators as I've worked on this passage. They talk specifically about this perspective that's being offered to Ahaz here. Oswald says, in every circumstance, there's two perspectives, the human and the divine. And as here, the two are frequently in conflict. This is a matter of perspectives. Smith says, the greatest danger was to be controlled by fear and discouragement. So Isaiah exhorts Ahaz to not be afraid and not to lose heart. These exhortations call Ahaz not to look at this war through the perspective of human eyes, but from God's perspective. How do we view the crisis? Brueggemann says, the confrontation of prophet and king is a continuation of faith versus fear and the two worlds that result from faith or from fear. Brueggemann says, Ahaz is not called to a spiritual enterprise, but to a concrete public action as king that proceeds on the conviction that Yahweh stands at the center of this crisis and he will prevail. Ahaz is called to live in an alternative world governed by this faithful God and by none other. What do you see when you see the crisis? What do you see when you see the crisis? Do you see primarily the crisis? If so, you're going to look through the lens of fear and insecurity. And if that's the lens that you're looking for or looking through, it will move you at your heart, at your soul, at your motivating will factor inside of your heart. It's going to move you to seek security because you're operating from a vantage point of insecurity. But if in fact you're operating from the vantage point of security, you don't have to manipulate anything. All you have to do is stand still and behold the salvation of the Lord. You say, this is a mess. I'm sure glad this problem's not mine. I'm sure glad it's his. I wonder what God's going to do for us this time. And life becomes an adventure of faith. Not that it's always fun, right? But it becomes an adventure as you watch God take one more step to provide and one more step to provide. It's kind of like a sheep. It's kind of like we have a verse about it. The Lord is my shepherd. I don't have to worry about anything. All of my wants, all of my needs are already addressed because my shepherd knows. Okay? So as we come to this text, we have to keep in mind what we looked at last week. Last week we saw the vision of God high and lifted up, holy, holy, holy. And we saw that when our vision of God is large, we tend to live life large. And Isaiah, for the rest of his life, from this initial call to ministry, he has this view of God. In fact, we're going to get to it in chapter 40. I think it's down in verse 9. He's going to say, behold your God. Look at this king, high and lifted up. He's able to spread out the heavens with the span of his hand. He's able to weigh the dust in a balance. He takes up the nations as though they were a drip off the bucket. Behold your God. He's high and lifted up. He's huge. He's mighty. He's spectacular. He's magnificent. He is great and he is good. What we want to examine this morning is the correlating opposite. When your vision of God is small, you can't help but live life small. Let me ask you something this morning. And I want you to write it down in the corner of the notes that you're taking this morning. If I were to ask you, are you living life large or are you living life small? What would you put down on that paper this morning? Go ahead and write it down. Don't let anybody else see it. But I want you to see it later this week. Are you living life large or are you living life small? The question is why? And the only answer is this. If you're living life large, it's only because you're viewing God large. Now, you might be thinking that you're living life large without viewing God large. But if God isn't your viewpoint, the things that you're counting large in your life can only be material things. They can only be temporary things. That's actually living life small. If you're living life small, there's really only one reason for it. It's because you're not viewing God as large. You're viewing God small, therefore you're living life small. The two have to go together. The question is, which pair of lenses are you looking through? How are you looking at this world? Through fear or through faith? What kind of clarity do you have as you view the crisis in your life? Because every crisis brings decision. Every decision brings a destiny. It brings us closer to that destiny. So, I think Ed Welch captures this thought rather well in his little book. When people are big and God is small. If you've not read this book, I encourage you to pick it up. It's all of $12. And this will change the way you look at God, at life, at people, and at yourself. It's absolutely essential read. If you haven't gotten that one, please do. You will be blessed by it. As we come to this passage this morning, I'd like us to look at six dynamics of this complicated relationship between faith and fear. Now, I want to be careful how I ask the question, because I'm not going to say how many are living life with fear. Because fear is one of those things, it's an emotion, right? It's there. We get afraid. And getting afraid isn't necessarily a bad thing. But living fearfully is a bad thing. So there's this dynamic of having fear and living by fear. One is a reaction, the other is we're going to actually find out, the other is a choice. So there's this dynamic between this complicated relationship between faith and fear. And the first thing I'd like us to see in verses 1 through 9 is that fear is the spiritual opponent of genuine faith. So it's not that those who have faith never experience fear, but those who walk by fear are not walking by faith. You can't walk by faith if you're walking in fear. So it says here in verse 2, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. They're afraid. Okay, this is a reaction. They've just received news that Syria is in league with Ephraim. So there's real reason for their fear. Earlier, Ahaz had been harassed both by Syria and later by Israel, two separate countries, and they had harassed him, they'd beaten him. Israel in particular had beaten him and killed 120,000 of his men of valor in a single day. 120,000. That's just with one country. And now they're teaming up together. Oh, and by the way, at this time, Edom to the south and Philistia to the west are also harassing Ahaz at this time. Things aren't looking good for the good guys, right? So now they've teamed up together in the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. And you've got these two nations that are bigger and tougher than Judah, just to the north. And they've come together. So they're trying to build up an alliance so that they can stand against their northern neighbor, Assyria. So we've got these smaller nation states that are that are tough. They're tougher than Judah, and they've teamed up together, and they're trying to form an alliance. They want Judah to join them. Ahaz says no, so they're going to come, and they're going to make it happen so that they can stand as a threesome against Assyria to their north. As they come, verse 4 says that they come with a strong personal animosity. He says, be careful and be quiet. Don't let your heart faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrand at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. These guys are angry and they're coming for you. And they come with a careful, intentional purpose. It says in verse 5, they have devised evil against you. So this is a normal reaction, to be afraid. They're bigger than me. They've got a very specific vendetta against me. And then in verse 6, they come with a clear and specified goal. They want to conquer. They want to terrify. And they want to depose Ahaz and instill Tabeel as the king. So they want to stick in this compliant leader, this puppet king, and they want to remove Ahaz from being king. This is a life and death proposition for Ahaz in particular. So look again at what's happening here. Verse 2. Who's told about this alliance? What's the phrase that's referenced there? The house of David. It doesn't just say Ahaz. Let's look how God introduces Ahaz up in verse 1. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, this is what's happening. Why at this point are we introduced to Ahaz through all of his ancestors? Who cares who his ancestors are? Well, it kind of matters. It goes back to Uzziah. Uzziah is the great king, right, that we just saw in chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and lifted up. Uzziah was one of those kingly kings. He's one of those guys where Judah prospered under his leadership. He was tough. He was strong. He was proud in a good way until he became proud in a bad way, and his heart was lifted up to his own destruction. But the point is that this king follows in the line of the kings of Judah. These are the house of David. This is a dynasty that's received a promise from God that their kingdom will last forever. There's always going to be a king on the throne. Now you start to see something of the significance of what's happening here. Let's take Ahaz off the throne, the son of David, and we're going to put some no-namer in there to do what we want him to do. Ahaz is like, whoa, it's all about me. The text says, it's not all about you, Ahaz. There's something bigger at stake here. But all he can see, looking through his lens of fear, is, they're coming to get me, 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 me. And the text says, no, it's not just about you. There's bigger stakes in this game. And that's actually going to be a comfort to him, or it's supposed to be later on. There's a real reason for this crisis. David says, what you're trusting in is most clearly revealed during a crisis. God brought this crisis on Ahaz to show how empty his soul was and how great his need is to trust in the Lord. Let's get a little idea of what this king is like. Can you turn back in your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 28? 2 Chronicles chapter 28. Let's get just a little personal biography of King Ahaz. Second Chronicles, chapter 28, verse 1. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. But he walked in the ways of the kings of the northern tribes of Israel. He even made metal images for the Baals. And he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and he burned his own sons as an offering, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Verse 5, therefore the Lord his God gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, who defeated him and took captive a great number of his people. So on and so forth. That didn't get his attention. Defeat by Israel didn't get his attention. Edom plaguing him doesn't get his attention. Phoenicia doesn't get his attention. Philistia, all of these different things that God is using in his life, he's just seeking other gods. He's manipulating more ways to find security in his insecurity. So God gives him a bigger insecurity. And God is going to surface in Ahaz's life, what is it that you're trusting in? We have to remember what position Ahaz holds, not just in Judah, and not even just in the history of Israel. We have to understand where Israel fits in the history of the world, right? Because way back in Genesis 12, God had told Abraham, through you, all families on earth will be blessed. So God brings them out of Egypt. He puts them in a place where it's flowing with milk and honey. He gives them a law and says, walk with me and I will bless you. This will be my kingdom and I'll pour out on this place my glory. And he does. And Solomon is the wonder of the world as people are flocking to Jerusalem saying, let us find out about you. And in finding out about you, we're finding out about your God. And the Queen of Sheba says, your God must love you to put a man like you on the throne of his people. What an amazing God you serve. And that's exactly what Israel was supposed to be. That was exactly what Israel was supposed to do. Who's the king at this time? Ahaz. But if Ahaz isn't trusting in God, that's going to affect his own people. But what other people is that going to affect? Through you, all families on earth will be blessed. Ahaz has a small view of God. It affects his own soul. Ahaz has a small view of God. It affects all the people under his jurisdiction and dominion. Ahaz has a small view of God. And who does that affect? All families on earth. Let me ask you something. When you have a small view of God, who does that affect? It affects you, right? Your soul's all troubled and turned upside down. You're churning all that bottom of the muck of the Mississippi in your muddy soul. Who else does that spill over to? Your spouse, your family. Who else does that spill over to? Your friends, your neighbor, your church, your coworkers. Who else does that spill over to? People on the other side of the globe that you would have witnessed to, that you would have touched, that you would have reached if your heart wasn't so consumed with you. Is that amazing or what? Your fear clogs the artery of the gospel. And that's exactly what Ahab is doing. So as we find out what's going on, we find out that we can't give what we don't have. And so God is coming and he's surfacing in Ahaz's life, the king of God's people, the first obeyer of God's people. And he says, listen, son, let's talk. You've got a problem. I want to fix it. Let's deal with this because I'm going to put my finger on that part that's out of joint. So Isaiah finds him examining the city's water supply in verse 3. He's preparing for the siege, and he comes to him with his son, Shear-Jashub. You'll see in your notes there, Shear-Jashub means a remnant shall return. Okay, you're the king. You've heard that Israel and Syria two people that have beaten you before are coming to conquer you, kill you, depose you. And here comes a guy with a smart aleck, wet-nosed kid whose name just happens to be "A Remnant Shall Return." What are you thinking as king? A remnant of which side? Right? Does that mean a remnant of the bad guys is going to go home? Or does that mean they're going to conquer us, we're going to go away, and only a remnant's coming back? This named child becomes a significant player. And we're not told exactly how. We're not told exactly what happens in this exchange. We're just told that this boy has a name, and he's brought into the presence of the king, and apparently his name is made known. He is meant to be the embodiment of a message to this king. The idea is this. Understand the stakes here, king. Because this decision determines a destiny. This decision determines a destiny. So understand what's at stake in what you do next. So Isaiah brings him God's message. In verse 4, we find four imperatives. God tells Jeremiah, say to him, number one, be careful. The idea is to be watchful, be alert. This current situation requires of you great sobriety, great intentionality. Don't get intoxicated with your emotions. Don't let them run rampant. You be in control. So he says, secondly, be quiet. You cannot, you must not allow the noise of these circumstances to govern your responses. You must be quiet. And then he says, thirdly, do not fear. Interestingly, he doesn't make this as a suggestion. You might not want to be afraid. He doesn't offer this as some option. You don't need to worry. He gives it as a command. Don't be afraid. There's only two things that you can do with a command. You can either what? Obey or disobey. Let's ask this question. Are you responsible for your emotions? Don't be afraid. You can either obey, and the only other option then is disobedience. Huh. How often do we think of our emotions as something that we're responsible for? God says you have to get a grip on your emotions because you are responsible to control your emotions. You have no right to let your emotions control you. You have to control your emotions. Now, we're emotional beings, right? We get afraid. But we don't have the right to let fear govern us. We've got to bring them in underneath the umbrella of truth and govern our emotions by the truth. So lastly, he says, do not let your heart be faint. And the encouragement here is that this is a real possibility that your heart could get so wrapped up and so wrung out, so worn out with this anxiety that you'd become faint, you become tired, you lose heart. This is a real possibility, but it's not a necessity. You can man up. You can walk by faith rather than by sight. But it means walking by faith, not by sight. So the real key here to your heart is your eyes. What are your eyes looking at? Are they looking at circumstances or are they looking at God? Are they looking at truth? What are you listening to? The envoys from Syria, the envoys from Israel. Or are you listening to the prophet of God, the one who speaks the word of God, the one who gives the life of God and breathes that life into your soul? The most important thing to note here is that fear, rampant and ungoverned, is a choice. And it's a sinful choice if we let it take control of our lives. So Isaiah brings him God's perspective. He says, don't let your heart be fearful because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. Have you ever had a big fire, like a bonfire? You throw everything in there and you throw stumps, logs, whatever. And then the fire burns down and everything's about out. And there's still a larger branch that happened to make it through, and it's kind of smoldering there, right? The fire's gone. It's still kind of burning. It would burn you if you grabbed it and tried to move it with your hand, but it's on its way out. That's the idea here. There was a fire, but these guys are so yesterday. It doesn't matter. This is God's perspective. Then he says, verse 7, thus says the Lord, it shall not stand. They've said, let's go up and conquer. Let's terrify Israel. Let's set up Tabeel as king. It's not going to happen. Ain't going to happen. God said so. Wow. Wouldn't you love that? Somebody comes and says, hey, guess what? What you're afraid of ain't going to happen. What would you say? Glory. He's like, wait a minute. How do I know? It's a good question. And he's going to give him an opportunity to drill down on that in just a moment. Isaiah clarifies for him the significance of this moment. Up in let's look in verse 8. He says, I want you to understand, the head of Syria, the country, is Damascus, the city. And the head of Damascus, the city, is Rezin, the person. Okay? So, country, capital, king. We get that. We'll look down in verse 9. The head of Ephraim, country, is Samaria, city. The head of Samaria is this son of Remaliah, king. Country, city, king. What's sandwiched in between the country of Syria, the country of Israel? Within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. We're at roughly 736 BC. Within 65 years, not only will Israel be defeated by Assyria, but Esarhaddon will take the people from this place, deport them to other places, and bring other people in. Whatever's left of Israel isn't going to be Israel. So they're going to be defeated before that time, but they're going to be reconfigured within 65 years. They're not even going to be a people at that time. But here's the point. Why does God walk us through country, city, king? Country, city, king. And then say, oh, by the way, this country is going to no longer exist. Which country isn't going to exist? Syria or Ephraim? Which one? Ephraim. Ephraim isn't going to exist because of their alliance with who? Whom? Syria. Israel lines up with Syria, and Israel's no longer going to exist. What's working in Ahaz's heart? Hey, in order to beat these guys, I think I'll line up with Assyria. And there's an implicit warning. Ahaz, listen, there's a country, Judah. There's a city, Jerusalem. And there's a king, Ahaz, and that's you. And what happens to Israel because they've teamed up with Syria? You've got a decision in front of you, and that decision is going to determine your destiny. Who's in the driver's seat, Ahaz? It's you. Think long and hard about the next step that you're going to take. And then he says, down in verse 9, Ahaz, if you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. There's a word play here. The word firm in faith is the word believe, and then firm, it's kind of the same word, and this it's a double use of this term, and the usage is important because it's the same term that's at the heart of the Davidic covenant. 2 Samuel 7, verse 16. God tells David, your house and your kingdom shall be made firm, made sure forever before me. But God puts an if in there at this point. If you are firm in faith, then you will be firm. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Ahaz, there's a lot riding on this decision, so weigh carefully what you're about to do. Because it doesn't just affect you, it affects your city. It doesn't just affect your city, it affects your country. It doesn't just affect your country, it affects the house of David. It affects the Abrahamic covenant. It affects your ability to shine as a light in this crooked generation. Be careful what you're talking about here. Be careful about the decision you're about to make. He asks him, or he encourages him, to walk by faith. Ortland points out that Isaiah 7:9 makes faith in God the central and unavoidable question of our lives. This is, for Ahaz, what's at stake. Listen, Ahaz, are you going to walk by faith? Or are you going to walk by sight? Well, it's important for us to kind of drill down on what is faith, right? What is faith? I appreciate a couple different answers. Ortland says, faith is the God-awakened capacity to respond fully to Christ. If that's faith, then unfaith is the fragmentation and the breakdown of our inner beings, our intellect, our emotions, our will. And we start to work against each other as our world caves in and our life becomes small. But Brueggemann gives an explanation that I think is worth reading and highlighting, because this is what's at stake. He says, it's commonly agreed that this utterance of the prophet is the pivotal text upon the meaning of faith in the work of Isaiah, and indeed in the entire Old Testament. When somebody who works in Old Testament says that, you need to kind of sit up and pay attention. This is one of those quintessential demarcations or explanations of faith. Okay? Faith, or standing firm in faith, is not simply a matter of intellectual content or cognitive belief. You can talk to anyone on the street and say, do you believe in Jesus? And many, just because they're Americans, would say, I believe in Jesus. Does that make them a Christian? Not necessarily. Listen again. Faith is not simply a matter of intellectual content or cognitive belief. It is rather a matter of quite practical reliance on the assurance of God in a context of risk. So it's not just belief. It's trust. We could do a faith fall, right? Remember, one of the worst illustrations I've ever done as a pastor, as a dad, was when we were camping one summer. We missed church, so we're going to have church out at the campground. Me and my brother were both in seminary at the time, so we're going to conduct this church service at the campground. And we get my son, the seventh grader, you stand him up. I think he was younger than that, might have been a fourth grader. You stand him up on the picnic table, and my brother and I lock arms. We say, okay, you trust us? Okay, this is what faith looks like. Fall backward into our arms, just nice and straight, nice and stiff. We locked arms. My son went right back. I mean, he was perfect as a board. Boom. But you know what happens to a seventh grader who is as limber as a spaghetti noodle? His center of gravity, right? He folded, dropped like a spaghetti right between our arms, lands on the rock, and my brother and I just kind of look at each other like, that wasn't supposed to happen. He trusted us. We learned an important lesson that day. Who you have faith in matters most, right? You can have faith, but you can have faith in the wrong thing. But here's the point. Having faith means doing something about it, not just thinking. But faith surfaces in a context of risk. Are you walking by faith or are you walking by sight? Because the Bible says the just shall live by what? By faith. Faith isn't a finish line. Come to Jesus. Do you have faith in Jesus? Okay, once you have faith in Jesus, then you don't need faith anymore because you've had faith. No, faith is the starting line, not the finish line. Once you have faith in Jesus, now you walk by faith in Jesus. That's the point. So what is a Christian? It's not somebody who believed at some point in the past. A Christian is somebody who believes in the present. That's what a Christian is. Now, we don't do it perfectly. But if we don't do it at all and only bank it on something in the past, we're not Christians. Because faith is the starting point of a life of faith. It's not the finish line. So, Brueggemann continues to write, he says, faith means to entrust one's security and future to the attentiveness of Yahweh, making panic, anxiety, or foolishness unnecessary and inappropriate. It's to know oneself safe in risk. It's to place oneself in the reliable care of another. Now listen to this. How ludicrous that in the long history of orthodoxy, which guards cognitive formulations of truth, that those who often enforce right belief seem unable or unwilling to engage in deep trust. What he's saying is this. You can believe all the right things and not have faith. That's a scary thing. He says, because it's deep trust that redefines life situations. So let me ask you again. Do you have faith? Not just believing the right things, but are you willing to risk everything on what you know about God? Well, we read a story like this, and we see a king, and we see the large ramifications, and we're like, now we know this guy doesn't have faith. Stop looking at the king. Start looking at your life. How would you know if you have faith or if you don't? How would you know if you're manipulating your security or you're not? Are you willing to rest quietly in a God who is good? And if you're not, if you don't, what business do you have trying to share him with others? Because you can't give what you don't have. It's not till we learn faith in a God who's good that we can offer faith in a God who is good. So faith becomes the very essential, pivotal action point of this whole narrative. We have 6 points and we have 10 minutes. Let's see what we can do here, all right? Fear is the spiritual opponent of genuine faith. It's not that you can't experience both, but you can only hold to one or the other. Number two, both faith and fear are matters of relationship. So he says in verse 10, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, these are God's words now, to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Remember who God's talking to? This is the guy who's worshiping on every hill. This is the guy who's sacrificed his own children. This is the guy who's built metal images of Baal. And God says, I want to be your God. I want to be your God, Ahaz. Ask me a sign. Make it as high as the heavens. Ask me to do something with the stars. Ask me to do something with the sun. Ask me to make the moon do something. I can do it. It's mine. I'm God. Ask me for something from the grave. Ask me to bring back every one of those children that you burned in the arms of Molech. I can do it. I'm God. Ask me, Ahaz. I want to be your God. An amazing God. The invitation implies a personal introduction to both the goodness and the greatness of this God. But this invitation is diplomatically rejected. Verse 12. I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Deuteronomy says that somewhere. Don't put the Lord to your test. It sounds pious, but it's a bunch of bunk. It's hypocrisy. What would happen if Ahaz actually received a sign? He'd be responsible to believe, right? No. He's already manipulating his exit strategy. He's already manipulating his security strategy. He's already manipulating a covenant with Assyria, which, by the way, means he's going to have to swear by their gods. He's already made up his mind. He doesn't want truth because he's determined, he's chosen to walk by sight rather than by faith. And here's the whole point. Look down in verse 13. Jeremiah speaks, says, "Hear then, house of David. Is it too weary for you? Is it too little for you to weary men that you must worry my God as well? He gave you a chance, Ahaz. He wants to be your God. You said no thank you. Guess what? It's done. He will not be your God because you would not have him. He's my God, but he's not your God. You made that determination, not him. You remember that. When you said thank you, but no." Wow. What a scary thing. But here's the point. Faith is a matter of relationship, but so is fear. They're both a matter of relationship. Either you trust the one who is good, or you don't trust the one who is good. But the issue at stake is, what will you do with the one who is good? He is good. Faith is entering into a relationship of trust. Fear is walking away from his goodness and thinking you can handle things on your own. And before you start shaking your head at others, look in the mirror and ask yourself honestly, how often do I do that? Because we do. I do. I do. He says, therefore, verse 14, the Lord himself will give you a sign. You won't ask him a sign. God will give you a sign. And then we are confronted with one of the most controversial and celebrated passages in all the Old Testament. And the question is, does this uniquely refer to Christ? Does it specifically require an immediate fulfillment? There's several things we want to consider as we look at this. There's no way we're going to get through this text today. So Chris is going to preach next week, unless he wants to preach on the rest of this passage. We'll come back and pick it up in a couple weeks. But let's look at this one promise in verse 14. The Lord himself will give you a sign. Who's you? Look up at verse 13. Hear then who? House of David. Is this just for Ahaz? This is for the kingly household. One person said it's kind of like saying the White House. It means the president and his staff, his administration. This is for the house of David, for Ahaz et al. Ahaz and company, if you will. Okay. The Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. The word is Alma. It means an unmarried maiden or damsel. Never does it refer to one who's had sexual relations. So virgin is appropriate. In fact, it would be the best word to use in Hebrew if you meant virgin. There's other words, but usually they include a phrase like, and they never knew a man or something like that. This virgin is the right translation for this, and the Septuagint picks up on it. Virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. So this isn't to just Ahaz, it's to the house of David. It's in response to a lack of faith. Verse 15, he shall eat curds and honey. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that like lush and lots, or is it like little and anemic? We're like shaking our heads. Yes, it is. Is it lots or is it little? How many say lots? How many say little? Nobody says little. Okay, let's go down to verse 21. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. How many cows? How many sheep? Okay, is this a big herd or a little herd? It's not lots, it's little. Okay, and because of the abundance of milk that one cow and two sheep give, he will eat curds from a very limited livestock. And this is what he's going to live on, yogurt. and cottage cheese. Now we're getting the point, okay? Not vegetables from his garden, not meat from the pasture. He's living on milk product. You get it? No farms, just a limited livestock. And he will eat curds and honey. It's not because he's going to be a bee farmer. Where's he going to find this honey? Well, let's look down in the next verses. Let's look down at verse 23. In that day, every place there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it's going to become briars and thorns. A man will come there, and all the land will be briars and thorns. Verse 25, all the hills that used to be hoed with a hoe will be briars and thorns, briars and thorns, briars and thorns. Briar rabbit. Where's he going to find this honey? It's going to be wild honey. He's going to have to scavenge for anything to supplement his diet other than the stupid cottage cheese he's eating all day. Now, let me ask you again. Curds and honey, is it lots or little? It's little. This is a judgment passage. Okay? And kind of keep drilling down on what's going on here. The purpose of this condition is highlighted. Verse 15, he says, he shall eat curds and honey, not when, but so that he learns, he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. Well, how come, if it's so simple, why doesn't the ESV translate it that way? Well, because others have before this, and it's trying to follow in the tradition of other good translations. But as men have worked through this passage, this the letter L functions as a whole preposition. It, when it's tied to this participle to know, it functions with a purpose intention. And 40 times it's used this way. Never is this construction ever used as when somebody knows. It's always for the purpose of knowing. He will eat this limited fare in order to understand what is good and what is evil. And then we come down to verse 16. Before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. And again, I'm going to offer you a different translation, not because the ESV translators are stupid in translating this. This isn't it. It's because the Hebrew is exceptionally tricky at this point, and there's different options that are good. This would seem to make sense, but in the larger context, a different sense is probably needed. And again, I'm resting on the work of scholars. I'm not a Hebrew scholar. I can see the words that are there. I can know what the words mean. I can see which order they're in, but I can't quite understand how this all works. I need to rest on others. But the work that's been done, I think this is the better translation. The land is singular. We're referring to two different countries. If it refers to Israel and Syria, this isn't lands, a land, it's lands. The land of Israel, the land of Syria. He refers to one land. A one land with two kings. Okay? The word for dread. You can have the idea of being vexed by somebody or doing the vexine. And it probably has the idea of doing the vexine. What if we look at this lens? The land that you, Ahaz, are vexing will soon be deserted of the two kings that rule the one land, Judah and Israel. Ahaz, because you're going to call Assyria in to take care of Israel, that part of the land is going to be destroyed. But understand that Assyria is going to come in and wipe out your land as well. And eventually, Babylon is going to come and destroy you, and both kings in the one land are going to be gone before this Messiah comes. And you know why? The Messiah is going to come, and he's going to have to eat the fruits of your decision, Ahaz. There's still going to be a Davidic king, but no thanks to you. And when he comes, he's going to come and bear the consequences of your wrong choices. And so he's going to reference in verse 17, the days are coming that you haven't seen since the day that Ephraim left Judah. These two kings, this was devastating when this one land had two different kings. One day it's going to have no kings. And in that context, the Messiah will come. Not by your doing, but by the doing of your God. Is Ahaz going to see it? Nope. But it doesn't matter. This is the sign, and it will confirm that what I've said is true. Ahaz, you're met with a crisis. That crisis demands a decision, and that decision will determine your destiny. Don't look at these. We're going to look at these later, all right? But here's the point. Two lenses, fear and faith. Two different lenses, but they open up into two different worlds. Which world are you living in? Nothing shrinks your world like fear. You will make wrong choices if you are insecure. You're going to grab for security. You're going to grasp for security. You're going to find it in people. You're going to find it in things. You're going to find comfort in something that acts as a narcotic in your life just to numb the pain of the hurt and the fear. Nothing will shrink your world like fear does. But when your vision of God is small, you can't help but live life small. We've been trying in the past few weeks to connect this to this mission, leveraging all that you have and all that you are for the mission of God. Let me ask you something. What are you doing with the God-ordained crises in your life? Do you have a crisis right now? Something that's kind of pressing you in, kind of surfacing some emotions, demanding a decision? How are you stewarding that? What is it surfacing? Fear or faith in your life? What are you doing with this opportunity to trust? Because if fear is clouding your vision, you cannot, you will not live on mission. Because you can't give what you don't have. If you don't believe God is good, you're not going to convince anybody else He is either. Let's pray.